This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss Participaction's Community Challenge with Participaction's president, Brian Torrance. We'll find out about The Real Girl's Guide to Midlife with author Angela Burke. We'll learn how steroids are being chemically converted into disease treatments with researcher Dr. Stephen Sia. And lastly, we'll discover how to keep your pets safe in cold weather with integrative veterinarian Dr. Carol Osborne. Before we get to that, here's your Tonic Quick Shot. Scientists in Sweden have discovered a new tablet that may help people with type 2 diabetes and obesity lower their blood sugar and burn more fat without reducing appetite or losing muscle mass. The study was published in Cell by researchers from the Karolinska Institutet and Stockholm University. Unlike well-known drugs like Ozempic, which work by changing how the gut talks to the brain, this new treatment works directly on skeletal muscle. In animal studies, it improved blood sugar levels and body composition without the common side effects of GLP-1 drugs, such as stomach issues or muscle loss. Early human trials with both healthy volunteers and people with diabetes show that the medicine is well tolerated. Researchers say this could lead to treatments that support better metabolic health while keeping muscle strong, an important factor for long-term health and lifespan. The drug is based on a special form of beta-2 agonist designed to help muscles work better without overstimulating the heart. Because it works differently from the GLP-1 drugs, it may also be used together with them for even better results. A larger clinical trial is now being planned to test its effectiveness in more people. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Brian Torrance in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. This just in. Time thieves have been spotted across Canada. We've received reports of influencers and content creators stealing countless precious hours from hardworking citizens everywhere. Reports indicate thousands of hours worth of pickleball games, Pilates classes, and shooting hoops have been stolen thus far. Authorities are urging Canadians to stay alert and protect their physical activity time. Let's make room to move. Brought to you by Participaction. As we start our new year, many are thinking about resolutions that include being more active. Participaction is a nonprofit charitable organization and an enduring part of Canada's physical activity history, encouraging people to get healthy by getting active since 1971. Many of our listeners will probably remember Body Break with Hal Johnson and Joanne McLeod. Today, Participaction is keeping active and relevant to keep us moving. I'm pleased to welcome Participaction President Brian Torrance to The Tonic. Welcome to the show, Brian. How are you?
Thanks, Jamie. I'm doing well. Thank you.
So I remember, I'm aging myself. I remember the commercial breaks with Participaction from when I was young. And I think most Canadians have heard about Participaction. But I was impressed to see all the resources and initiatives you've developed to support the movement in Canada. So how are you engaging Canadians to support activity today?
Yeah, I think part of that history is we are kind of ingrained in people's memory, whether it be schools or whether it be that campaign that you were referring to with Hal and Joanne. So maybe I worked for other charities and you have to introduce yourself and what you do. But I think for Canada and Canadians, people really know what Participaction does. So it always helps me in those conversations to say, oh, yeah, I remember Participaction. So that's an honor and a privilege. And I'm incredibly humbled to be leading the charity now. Currently today, we work on a few different levels. We still do public education campaigns. We still need that reminder that physical activity is very important for our lives and for our health and well-being. In 2024, we reached 15 million people in terms of whether it be an initiative or someone listening or engaged with our public education campaign. And then we also understand that physical activity is not only just an individual choice. So if you have the motivation to be physically active, or people would say to go to the gym, and this is a very January conversation that people are going to flip a switch and suddenly have that motivation. Evidence tells us that they need supportive environments. So whether they need social support, or whether they need social environment support, or whether they need physical environment support. So participation works in terms of making sure that people have easier access to physical activity so they can be engaged with that really important health behavior.
It's interesting, you know, like if you work out at public gyms, and I used to before COVID, now I have a home gym, you know, you would see in January, everybody who's made their resolution would go out and get active. But the truth of the matter is, and I think this is what you're saying about support, it's sort of making it proximal so that people, you know, will continue doing it after the first few weeks, because, you know, I think what happens is that everybody has good intentions, but then it kind of falls off after a little bit unless you're motivated and you actually have that support. Is that sort of your understanding the way the psyche works when it comes to exercise?
Absolutely. Behavior change is a very complex, difficult thing. And maybe to give you a public health analogy is where we were as a society with smoking. You know, it took a long time for us to stop smoking on planes to now having essentially smoke-free environments everywhere we go, beyond maybe 15 feet beyond the front entrance of a building. So, like, it does take a long time, but we need help. You know, that health priority was provided by education. So we had more education on packages. We started to have more policy around it. We started to put taxation on it to change behavior. So behavior change is complex, and then when someone's trying to become physically active, I think the third Monday in January is called Blue Monday or something like that, because that's kind of the time also where people have lost this motivation, this new motivation to be physically active. So we want Canadians to be physically active, and we want Canadians to sustain their physical activity, because physical activity is not something that just happens here and there. It really does need to be normalized and ingrained into everything we do every single day for all Canadians.
You touched upon something that I've thought of, and that is, you know, I think there should actually be a tax incentive where people maybe get a deduction if they join a gym or buy fitness equipment that they actually use. You know, as preventative medicine, you know, we're finding out all the benefits, the collateral benefits to physical activity that people probably don't even think about for your overall health. But I'll get off my soapbox now and I'll ask you a question. I read in your impact report that you're committed to building more accessible culture of movement. What does that mean, and what are you doing?
Yeah, I think it's the normalization of movement. I think when we look at workspaces, you know, how many times do we just normalize? Is that going to be a walking meeting, or are we going to be sitting in the boardroom? So evidence would tell us that we provide, and we do this annual report card to give us the best evidence to know where we are. And evidence would say we don't need to go from, say, we need to get to 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity a week for adults. Now, we know we're not starting at zero. We know just naturally people do have physical activity in their lives. But how do we add more movement to one's life so we can get over 150 minutes? And when someone hears a guideline like 150 minutes, it's not just a number, it's an evidence-based number to say if we're going to be under 150 minutes, we're going to have more associated healthcare costs, which you alluded to. But if we're over 150 minutes, then we're going to have a better protection and better support for us to be healthy and well. To pick up on your last point around tax benefits, I don't know if we will see tax benefits in the short term, but what we have saw is in terms of like worker benefit or workspace benefits, insurance companies, they're starting to provide money back for not only health and healthcare and dental care, but we're also seeing money put towards mental health and wellness and physical activity and sport. So it is a very positive shift that we know we have to keep people healthy. We also know that physical activity helps workplace productivity. So if physical activity is within your workspace, we have 27% less absenteeism. And that's purely related to work productivity in that workspace. So we need to be moving and we need to be intentional on it.
An idea just occurred to me. If you really wanted people to get their 150 minutes, you should pair up with like the Humane Society and do like dog adoption. Because if you have to walk your dog, you know, 45 minutes a day, you'll accrue that 150 minutes pretty quickly, I would say.
Indeed, there's research there for people that have dogs. It's just another reminder, and to think of a social environment, pets can be part of that social environment, and they have to get out every single day. So we do see increased physical activity in households that have pets or dogs.
So I understand you've partnered with Novo Nordisk Canada Inc. To launch the Participations Community Challenge. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's our biggest initiative across the country that really does help enable physical activity in communities. So participation doesn't have all the answers. We know that whatever the issue, community is the answer. So what the Community Challenge does, partner with Novo Nordisk, is that we provide seed funding out to community groups that know their community best. So they can run a sport and physical activity initiative. We've seen active bingo, we've seen mall walking, we've seen junior baseball teams. But whatever the community needs in terms of trying to push and support physical activity, we provide a little bit of funding in terms of grant funding, and it allows those organizations to really address the issues that they're facing in their community. And also with Novo Nordisk, like, we know the answers to some of these bigger issues, societal issues. It's not just going to be public that's going to figure out. It's not just going to be private. So to partner in a public-private partnership with Novo Nordisk has really accelerated some of the goals that we both share in making sure that we have healthy communities across Canada. So Novo Nordisk has been a great partner, and we're excited to work with them in 2026 again.
Yeah, let's dig a little into Novo Nordisk. They're a leader, you know, obviously people know the name, a leader in type 2 diabetes and obesity chronic disease management. Why for you are they an ideal partner for the Community Challenge?
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget that we have shared goals. We're just coming about it at a little bit different angle or different approach. Obviously, Novo Nordisk has support for people living with type 2 diabetes, obesity, other chronic disease management, but they really do deeply care in the community approach to making sure that people are remaining healthy, or if they are living with chronic disease, that they are enhancing the most ultimate quality of life as well. So As a charity, Participation obviously supports active lifestyles, and we look upon it as a public health priority. And Novo Nordisk approaches it the same way, that this is really a public health priority to make sure that we are supporting people as much as possible in their health and well-being, not just for now, but for generations to come. So we definitely do see that chronic disease is generational. So if we can create healthy families now, we're going to have healthier families in the future as well.
How does the Community Challenge promote equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility, which are still important issues, at least in this country?
Yeah, very much. So I think sometimes where we've got it wrong to start there is we think there's one approach for the whole country. So, you know, you have a population health approach, you build a binder and you send that binder out to every community and they're like, there you go. You know, we're going to create everybody, everyone's going to be healthy. And I think we really need to slow down and bring the equity, diversity, and inclusion and accessibility lens to all the different programs that are run across the country. So a program in Sooke and Vancouver Island in BC looks very, very different than Winnipeg, maybe a Northern First Nations in Manitoba. So I think by bringing in that lens, we need to just be more intentional that there's going to be different needs in different communities. And Participation and Novo Nordisk, we really are supporting equity denied groups. So we have to make sure that it's not always a level playing field out there, and to be we need to be more comprehensive in how we address a community's needs and best support them, whether it be physically, whether it be emotionally, or whether it be socially, or other needs that they have within their community, to make sure that everybody has access. This is a health equity conversation, so access to sport, physical activity, recreation, and some of these other activities, you know, they shouldn't have barriers to that. And we're trying to bring down those barriers with Novo Nordisk to make sure everybody has an opportunity to participate.
So what's been the impact to date for the Community Challenge?
Yeah, we've sent out over $7 million in grants alongside Novo Nordisk to those communities. I think last year we had just over 900 communities involved. But what's most enjoyable about this job is some of those like more on the ground community stories. I know there's one school that we worked alongside in Southern Alberta on a First Nation, and they really looked upon how sport could improve student attendance. So they really looked upon sport not as in like a schedule, like basketball is going to be the beginning of the year and volleyball is going to be the end. They just really listened to their community, to what the activities that they wish to have. And then how do we then provide that opportunity or that sport all year round? So we just, it's those kind of stories that like the result of that is more youth coming to school, more youth graduating, more youth succeeding and moving on to post-secondary. So those are much broader stories than more people moving. But I think that's what people have to understand about physical activity. It is absolutely foundational to other really positive aspects in one's life or in a community's life. So the community challenges really start to identify some of those opportunities and try to lift up the community to make sure that everyone has access.
Can I guess what is Canada's most active community? I want two guesses. Okay.
Okay, go.
All right.
Yeah.
My first guess, because I traveled there this summer and everybody was outside doing stuff, is Quebec City. Am I right? No? Okay.
No.
Okay.
It was not the most recent, most active city. I was also in Quebec City just recently, and I'd agree with you. There's a culture of walkability and pedestrian friendly. The small European kind of streets really
Yeah.
did encourage active transportation.
Everybody had weighted vests and they were busy running around the city when we were there. Plus, we did a lot of hiking in Champlain Park. So my guess number two is going to be somewhere in BC. I'm gonna guess Vancouver.
You're right on BC, and you're right. You're right on next to Vancouver. So the most active city last year was Richmond,
Okay, so that's pretty good,
and
right? That's pretty good, right?
very good. That's very good. And when people do that, like when they think about our most active cities, like when you are in a community that is active, you can feel it.
Yep.
And not only do you see physical activity, but you also see social connection. Like if you're on a trail walking with somebody, if you're going for a run, like people will nod at you and say hello.
100%.
So
Yep.
it's a bit of a culture of a city or a community, and Richmond definitely had a lot of different initiatives that really did focus on that. And my understanding of Richmond is that they didn't see themselves as an active city, so they really had some wonderful leadership, and they're really intentional to make sure that we want to support our citizens in being active, and they had a host of different ways that they increased activities and access for their citizens.
Fantastic. We have time for one last question. Is there anything else you want to share today?
Yeah, maybe just to highlight the importance of the just to underpin the public health issue here. So sometimes we think sport, physical activity, and recreation is a nice to have, and it'd be a fun little activity to do after school. But we really have to start to position those activities as very much foundational to what health and wellness looks like for our communities, but also for those connections and on how we are resilient as a nation. And when we hear things like nation-building tools, like physical activity is absolutely a nation-building tool to one only connect us to each other, but also improve our well-being and our productivity and our mental health. So it really does help some of those other issues that we're facing in society. And physical activity is fun. So be engaged with physical activity and sport and recreation or arts and culture, whatever you end up choosing. But physical activity is very much foundational to all those really positive things.
For those who are interested in learning more about participation and the community challenge, you can visit participaction.com. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Grateful for your time.
That was Brian Torrance. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lovers Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Angela Burke is an award-winning marketing strategist, mother of three, bonus mom to four, and fierce advocate for women reclaiming their stories at midlife. She splits her time between California and Australia with her partner, proving that the best chapters often require a passport, grit, and zero apologies. You can learn more about her at www.realgirlsguide55.com or follow Angela on Substack. Welcome to the show, Angela. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me, Jamie.
So the notion of aging gracefully, what does that mean to you? And why do you reject that narrative?
Well, I do reject it because I don't think it exists. I don't think that aging gracefully is something that happens to most women or most people, right? We are living, breathing things. We go through changes, whether those changes come in the form of relationships, body, appearance, identities, careers, and none of that feels graceful. And if you add to it the idea that women have a host of hormonal changes that happen as well over sometimes decades, none of that feels gracefully. And I also think it puts a lot of pressure on us women to do something better than what we're doing. And I think it's just wrong.
I think of gracefully, like the notion of gracefulness is sort of doing it like with a smile and not complaining and not responding to external events. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
I think it is. And, you know, that idea is one that for many women, we've been modeled, right?
Yeah.
We spend a lot of our decades sort of editing ourselves. We have to keep the peace. We have to not cause waves. We have to be quiet. We have to shrink. We have to play small. And that just is damaging. It creates, stories about us, internal dialogues that lead us to, you know, direct our life in a certain way. And I think what happens when you get to sort of midlife is you become exhausted from having to perform and contort yourself just to be in your own life. And that's just patently wrong. So I do think that it shows up in a lot of ways for us women in that. And I also think it shows up in ways that, you know, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to age beautifully and like right, quote unquote, right. And in reality, you know, a lot of us in this stage get hit with lots of unforeseen circumstances, and there are no right answers to how to do life and how to do your life. And I think aging gracefully just kind of puts undue pressure and sets this bar that is like not attainable. And then you kind of look at it and go, why would I want that anyway?
So my understanding is you think that midlife isn't sort of a period of calmness, but rather, as you describe it, a karate kick to the ribcage. What were some of the most surprising or defining moments in your life that shattered the script that you had been following previously? I guess previous efforts to sort of be graceful, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, if I really kind of unwind the clock and, you know, sort of evaluate the internal stories that I had kind of crafted or had been crafted for me that I live by, whether that was about aging or my worth or desirability or ambition, all of it, those old scripts were things that were pretty damaging for me. And they ran deep for me. And I noticed that there were a lot of common patterns from my own life, as well as the women that I interviewed for the book. And all of that was validated by the experts that I interviewed for the book. You know, for me, a lot of those stories had to do with the fact that my happiness needed to come last, that I was wrong for wanting more, that I didn't deserve more. And these things sort of surfaced in many ways, whether they were at work for me, in my relationships, just being with myself. And I think that a lot of that for me and for many women that I talk to is rooted in this idea that like, you're not enough as you are. You know, I'm not enough as I was, that somehow, you know, I needed to quiet myself. I needed to edit myself to exist in my own life. And it was just wrong.
So in Real Girl's Guide to Midlife, you dive into the emotional terrain that many women stay silent about: divorce, dating, friendship grief, panic at 3 a.m. So which of these resonated most with you?
For me, what was interesting is like a lot of these things came crashing at the same time. So if I sort of roll back the clock on myself, I actually had this book idea when I was 35, and it was going to be called The Real Girl's Guide to Over 35, because I was at this kind of inflection point. I was a new mom. I had two kids. I was married for about 5 years at that point. I was at this fork in the road with my career. My hormones were starting to shift, and I'm looking around and I'm watching my friends who seemingly have it all together. And I'm like, is it me? Am I the crazy one? And nobody was talking. Because, you know, 20 years ago, anything that you, first of all, the words like perimenopause and menopause were not discussed. The only thing I remember my mom and my grandma talking about was the change. I'm using air quotes, you can't see.
Yeah.
But it was like this mythical thing that just like nobody was speaking about. And then on top of it, it was just all these other like perceived crises that were hitting me all at once. And you know, that folder that I started with chapter outlines and questions and topics and, you know, the structure, literally, it was a red folder, literally and figuratively got buried. And when I retired from my career last December, I found the folder and I opened it. And I realized that a lot of the same topics, a lot of the same struggles, that questions that I was having still existed for me. They took a slightly different shape now, but they still existed. And again, I'm looking around and none of my girlfriends are talking about this stuff. You see celebrities writing about menopause, and I think it's great, but I am not a celebrity, right? I'm just a real girl trying to figure it all out. And so, you know, what I started to realize though was that I wasn't alone. This set of transitions that I was feeling is not a crisis, and it was bringing me clarity. And the other reality that I recognized was that looking back 20 years ago, I wasn't even falling apart then. But for me, the highlight of all of these changes came together when I was in my mid-40s. I was in a super stressful job. I had three boys. I was going through a divorce. And I was, unbeknownst to me at that time, about ready to exit menopause and become postmenopausal. And I just remember, like, I was just a rage case all the time. And it, you know, in writing my book and in writing my Substack, it made me kind of look back at that time. And I had to give myself a whole lot more grace because I wasn't falling apart then, but it really felt like it. Really, really felt like it.
What are some of the rules and roles and expectations, beliefs and habits that you think are holding women back in your situation?
I think for all of us, they're slightly different, but they're probably rooted in a couple of kind of mindsets, right? This idea that, you know, we are alone in our struggles, that it must just be us. We must be crazy. We're the problem, that we're not enough, that we're just not enough. And that our existence is, you know, really to the benefit of making everybody else comfortable. And, you know, for me, a lot of those things, you know, certainly manifested themselves. And I saw a lot of these patterns emerge in talking to women for the book. And the reality is, this idea of, am I even present in my own life? It doesn't happen like a light bulb. It kind of starts, you know, when you look around and you go like, God, my life doesn't even feel like my own. And, the key is to spotting some of these moments where you start to feel like you disappear a little bit. What I've seen emerge in the book and in talking to the experts is this idea that shrinking kind of shows up fast, and it can show up in ways such as, I'm saying yes to something when I really mean to say no. I'm softening my opinions, right? Either with people that I love, my family, at work, or I'm feeling like I'm sliding to the edges of my own life. And I saw this, I felt this, I experienced this myself.
Okay. So it's a disconnect, right? Because women who, you know, modern women have careers. There are more women in higher education than men right now. They're earning more. They perhaps don't need their spouses for income in the way that traditionally women did. So you have that for most women, or at least a good portion of women. Yet what you're describing is a very sort of stratified and classical, I guess, interpretation of like the role of women in relationships. That's what I'm hearing
from
you.
Well, I think both things can be true, right? You know, I had a really successful career. Right. I was an executive, yet there were parts of my life that I didn't feel that powerful. And I think that that's kind of the experience that a lot of women feel, right? You know, you look at women who seemingly like have it all, and then, you know, either that woman gets vulnerable or the cracks start to show and you're like, oh, maybe she didn't. And so I think that both of those things can be true. And I think for a lot of us women, not everybody, right? But for a lot of us women, we're sort of taught to, you know, grab onto the things that seemingly look so good, and we should somehow be grateful, which we are, but like that gratitude comes off our back, right? A woman in higher education who's got a great professorship and a, you know, great tenure and a great title, she's not gifted that. She gets it because she's worked for it. Yet there's so many other parts of our life, whether it's hormonal or relationships or roles, caregiving, you know, the expectations are high. And so you can feel super powerful and super confident at any point in any one of these aspects of your life. Yet still a lot of these internal stories, these battles and these feelings like, gosh, we're just never doing enough. It's never enough. I can't say what I need out loud. They're real. And the struggles are real. And I think that that's what makes this time a little bit tumultuous for some of us.
Time for one last question. And that is, if this is resonating with our listeners, what would you say is a great first step to sort of getting beyond some of these outdated ideas?
Absolutely. So I write in the book about this manifesto concept, and the full exercise is in the book. But I think that it starts with one simple thing. Identify something that you are done carrying in your life that you want to release. And then identify something that you are ready to reclaim. And you're almost making that a personal contract with yourself, right? And this time in life isn't about blowing up your whole life, but it is about naming the belief or the habit or the expectation that you want to let go of. And even saying it out loud, that mindset shift is huge. Another example of that is like the idea of very simple sentences, right? I'm not available to do something. Our pattern as women in some cases is, oh, I have to say no with a long essay. No, you don't. No is a full sentence. I'm not available. That's three words. I disagree. I need rest. I need help. These are simple sentences that allow you to take what you're feeling and what you want and name them out loud. And I think that that is a really powerful step.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, and I hope I get to come back.
That was Angela Burke. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss converting steroids into clinical treatments on The Tonic. Feeling low on energy? Orange Naturals can help. For over 15 years, Orange Naturals has been making family-friendly natural health supplements, including their B-complex with L-theanine, right here in Canada. This synergistic blend of full-spectrum active B vitamins boosts energy production by helping you metabolize carbs, fats, and proteins more efficiently. Plus, each dose contains 200 milligrams of L-theanine to promote relaxation without reducing alertness. Find Orange Naturals B-Complex at grocery stores like Loblaws and Metro, pharmacies like Shoppers Drug Mart and Rexall, or online at well.ca and orangenaturals.com. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Stephen Saya has always been fascinated by how proteins, made up of simple building blocks of 20 amino acids, could serve the diverse functions required in living systems. Currently, at the University of Guelph, Dr. Sia's lab is studying enzymes related by convergent and divergent evolution to decipher structure-function relationships in proteins. target enzymes being investigated include those important for environmental pollutant degradation and those that are medically relevant for development of new therapeutic drugs. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sia. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
So I understand that you recently uncovered, you and your team, the 3D structure of steroid-transforming enzymes in bacteria. Can you explain why that's important for turning steroids into medicines?
Okay. First of all, when I talk to people about steroids, they always think of anabolic steroids. So anabolic steroids are, of course, mimics of the sex hormone testosterone and are sometimes used illicitly by athletes to build muscles. But besides the sex hormones, there are other types of steroids that are important in human development and physiology. For example, the corticosteroids regulate our immune system and control things like inflammation. And there are also steroids called bile acids that are secreted into the intestine, acting as detergents to emulsify our the fats that we have in our diet, so to help it help the absorption of fats. So steroids have diverse structure and functions. And steroids are also quite complex molecules that contain at least 17 carbon atoms. So they are difficult to synthesize chemically. So steroid drugs that are used in a clinic, such as cortisone, requires the assistance of microorganisms that contain enzymes that catalyze key steps in the synthesis of these drugs. So going back to your question, why the determination of the 3D structure of these steroid-transforming enzymes are important? Well, firstly, it allows us to determine how these enzymes recognize the specific steroid, given that steroids have diverse structures. How does these enzymes recognize that specific steroid and how they do the chemical transformation? So knowing this information, I think, will help us improve and manipulate these enzymes to produce desired steroid compounds that could be used as medicine.
So how did researchers historically use bacteria to convert natural steroid precursors into therapeutic compounds?
Okay, let's look at cortisol as an example. So the story of how cortisol is produced for clinical use is quite interesting. So cortisol is a natural steroid produced by humans and animals. So in the 1930s, scientists discovered that cortisol could potentially be used to treat inflammatory disease, but they can't get enough of this cortisol from animal sources to conduct clinical trials. So later it was discovered that one can chemically synthesize cortisone from ox bile. So ox bile, of course, contain bile acids. And I mentioned earlier, there are steroid compounds that humans and animals produce. So the synthesis of cortisone from ox bile is, however, quite elaborate, requiring like 35 chemical steps. Nevertheless, they are able to synthesize enough of this cortisone to test it on a patient that is bedridden due to rheumatoid arthritis. So rheumatoid arthritis is an autoimmune disease that causes inflammation of the joints. So remarkably, the patient that received this treatment with cortisone was able to walk the next day. So the cortisone is hailed as a miracle drug. But the 35-step synthesis of cortisone from ox bile is not a viable strategy to produce sufficient quantities of this drug to treat the many people that require it. So later it was discovered that plants can produce a steroid that can be more easily converted to progesterone, which is also a sex hormone that is also clinically useful to treat several human disorders. Mm-hmm. It was discovered that progesterone can be modified by a fungus, producing a product that can then be chemically converted to cortisone. So later, a bacteria was found to convert cortisone to prednisolone, which is a more potent form of corticosteroids. So today, both cortisone and prednisolone are used to treat inflammation, and they are still produced from plant steroids using a combination of both chemical and microbial transformation.
So what makes using bacteria to convert steroids potentially better or safer? Like, why is it better? Why do we want to do that?
I think there's several reasons. First, it reduces the need to use harsh and toxic chemicals for the chemical conversion. Also, bacterial enzymes that catalyze this reaction are more specific, and they have what we call stereo and regioselectivity. This means that the bacterial enzymes are highly precise. They will make chemical changes to specific positions of the steroid molecule, and they also create products that have specific shapes. So specificity and selectivity of steroid transformation is very difficult to achieve using traditional chemical methods. But enzymes have the natural capability of this specificity and selectivity. So they are well suited to make these steroid drugs.
We have, you know, lay people listening to the show. Can you walk us through what the process might look like from, you know, the use of the bacteria in the lab to actually getting perhaps a pill to a patient or you know, a lotion or some form of medicine to the patient? So what are the steps?
Okay. So let's look at cortisone, for example. So cortisone is now synthesized from plant steroids. So you will need to extract the steroidal compounds from the plant. And then using both chemical means as well as adding the bacteria to produce the drug cortisone used for clinical use. I think in the future, it may be possible to actually produce cortisone using microbial transformation of plant steroids alone. There are a few hurdles that we still need to overcome, but I think that is a possible goal that we can try to achieve. So there's no need to now to rely on chemical methods. So we are just using one microbe to make cortisone from plant steroids. Going beyond that, I think bacteria could potentially also produce new types of steroidal compounds that may have therapeutic properties. So, of course, this will require us to use the bacteria to synthesize the variety of steroidal compounds and for the pharmaceutical companies or research labs to systematically test the therapeutic potentials of these compounds.
What are some of the challenges that are faced by those doing the research to get us to the point where, you know, we're going to have more of these steroidal drugs?
Yeah. So one thing is we don't understand or we don't know all the possible kinds of enzymes that can modify steroids. And we also don't fully understand how these enzymes catalyze this reaction. So that's one thing that we need to work on to do more research on these enzymes. The other thing is if we look at cortisone synthesis, for example, how do we get to just using a bacteria to make cortisone from plant steroids? Well, there are several steps that still requires us to use chemical methods. So there are some gaps where we have to discover new enzymes to replace those steps that now require chemical synthesis.
At the top of the interview, you mentioned how there's all sorts of steroids in our body that aren't anabolic steroids that perform all sorts of functions. What does your work mean for understanding human health beyond just the new drug development? Are there implications for sort of better understanding of our bodies?
Yes. So one other area that we are studying is bile acid transformation by bacteria. So as I mentioned earlier, bile acids are synthesized in our liver and secreted into the intestine to help us digest and absorb fats from our diet. So there are bacteria that live in our intestine that can chemically modify this bile acid, producing what is called secondary bile acids. So these secondary bile acids can exert both positive and negative effects on human health. For example, certain secondary bile acids are correlated with development of gallstones, as well as inflammatory bowel disease. So understanding how these bacteria in our gut transform bile acids may lead to new strategies to help maintain human health.
Looking ahead, what kind of diseases or conditions do you think might benefit most from this kind of steroid-based treatment that you're working on?
So steroids are used widely now as anti-inflammatory drugs to treat arthritis, as I mentioned earlier, as well as other inflammatory diseases like asthma, allergies, and so on. They are also used to treat certain types of cancers and are also used to treat various hormone disorders. I think in the future, there are potential to use steroids to ensure healthy gut balance, the bile acids that I talked about earlier. And given the diverse functions of steroids, I think there is still possibility that there could be other human diseases that can benefit from steroid-based treatment.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Stephen Sia. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to keep your pets safe in the cold on The Tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now. This just in. Time thieves have been spotted across Canada. We've received reports of influencers and content creators stealing countless precious hours from hardworking citizens everywhere. Reports indicate thousands of hours worth of pickleball games, Pilates classes, and shooting hoops have been stolen thus far. Authorities are urging Canadians to stay alert and protect their physical activity time. Let's make room to move. Brought to you by Participaction. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wildcrafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Veterinarian Dr. Carol Osborne is a board-certified diplomat of the American Board of Anti-Aging Medicine and has pioneered the exploration of new therapies for the treatment and prevention of age-related degenerative disease, as well as optimum health and performance for pets. She created and patented PAWS, Pet Anti-Aging Wellness System, and authored Naturally Healthy Dogs and Naturally Healthy Cats. Dr. Carol has appeared several times on Fox and Friends, The Today Show, Good Day LA, and Discovery's Animal Planet. She's also been featured in USA Today, The LA Times, Ladies Home Journal, Women's World, In Style, The New York Daily News, and this very show, The Tonic. Welcome back, Carol. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me, Jamie.
So it's cold. It's cold in Toronto. You and I were discussing off air. It's cold where you are in Ohio. What are the most common cold weather risks owners underestimate, especially when it comes to severe temperatures and frostbite with their pets?
Well, a lot of times I think people don't realize that it's just as cold for your pet as it is for you and I. So unless you have, you know, a Malamute or a Siberian Husky with a double thick hair coat, if, you know, you're going to put on a jacket, in most cases, your pet needs a little jacket as well. When it comes to feet, remember, you're not going to walk outside barefoot, and a lot of pets are going to be reluctant to walk outside as well. They make all kinds of great booties for pets if your pet is willing to wear them.
Yes.
If not, if you can spritz your pet's feet off even with just a little bit of water, pat them dry when they come inside, a lot of pets won't go out and do their business outside. So constipation and things like that can be a problem. Depending on the severity of the weather, you can maybe shovel a little path off just outside the door and, you know, go out there with him or her and coax them along so that bathroom habits, you know, remain normalized, if you will. When it comes to antifreeze, remember just a teaspoon is deadly. So if you're working on your radiator or changing things in the car, make sure if there's a leak, you clean it up real well, and store containers high up in pet-proof containers, because that is a true life and death emergency when it comes to your pet.
I wanted to ask you a question. So
sure.
I have an Aussie, part Aussie, who loves to be outside in the cold. And as soon as she sees the snow, she's excited to get out there.
Sure.
But even if they're excited to be out in the cold, and a lot of dogs like the cold, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily okay to be out for an extended period, does it? Or does it?
Absolutely not. You know, your pet is like a little kid. It's fun. It's great. It's fluffy. You can roll in it and everything else. But you have to be the parent. So if you've been outside for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, you got your jacket on and you're feeling chilly, come on inside and take a break.
So I know when I'm experiencing frostbite, I can feel it, right? You know, you feel it in the extremities.
Sure.
When you have a pet, how can you tell if they're suffering from frostbite? What would it look like?
You know, that's a great point. First of all, the risk areas for frostbite are the ears, the nose, the tip of the tail, and the ears. Frostbitten areas of skin initially turn a reddish color, and then after a little bit of time, they turn gray. So if you think that might be a problem, bring your pet inside. Easiest thing to do is give them a warm bath and then wrap them up in a towel. You never want to rub an area that you think might have frostbite. Just wrap them up, you know, maybe give them a little warm chicken soup. You can call your vet, you know, just to be sure everything's fine. So most pets are just fine and recover without incident. But it's just good to know what you're doing, you know what I'm saying, and make sure that that's not an issue for, you know, for your pet.
When is it time to take your pet to the vet if you think there's been a frostbite? Like, how would it manifest?
Well, I think anytime, Jamie, that you have a question or a concern about your pet, no matter what it might be, the best thing to do is just pick up the phone, call the vet, and ask whatever the question might be. It's always better to be safe than sorry, if you will. You know, and sometimes what you or I might interpret might be different than what's actually going on. So, you know, your vet is your first line of defense, and it's always worth a phone call, if you will.
I have a pet who, under normal circumstances, because she's part Aussie, has like tremendous energy and needs a lot of walks. What do you do when it gets really, really cold? Like, you know, where there's like a, where it's like minus 14 Celsius or something like that. And you know, they need to get out their energy. How do you do that? Do you do shorter walks? Do you just not take them out and play with them indoors? What would you recommend?
I think shorter walks make a lot of sense. And then I think you need to get creative. There's lots of fun things you can do inside the home. You just, once again, have to put on your creative thinking cap and, you know, whether it's jogging up and down the stairs or around the house or, you know, even making up a little series of exercises and doing that with your pet. There are all kinds of things you can do. And today, you know, the facilities available for pets basically mimic those available for people. So in various areas, there's all kinds of, you know, indoor dog camps and playgrounds that might be available in your area. You just once again have to see what's out there so that you can keep everybody happy during these cold weather times.
So up in Toronto, where I am, they salt like crazy. And, you know, it's I know that it's damaging for the pets, you know, and the larger, you know, chunks, leaving aside the salt is bad for their skin, it also gets into the crevices of their paws. What should we be looking out for when it comes to ice melting?
Once again, any kind of rock salt or de-icing chemical is very irritating. So when your pet comes inside, you can make a little spritz bottle of, you know, water, distilled water, spritz their feet off, or have a little plastic container where they can dip their feet in to get the stuff off, and then just take a little towel, dry off the foot pads, go in between the toes and make sure everything is clean and dry. If your pet decides to eat the ice melting product, that's probably not good either. You know, they might drool, vomit, kind of get depressed. And again, if you think that happened, you know, give the vet a call.
So let's talk about ingesting. So for example, you were talking about antifreeze, which, you know, smells very chemically to me. I find it surprising that a pet would even attempt to eat it. What do we do if they've consumed antifreeze? How do we know, and what's the protocol?
If you think your pet got into antifreeze and you have the container, you're pretty sure, grab the pet, grab the container, jump in the car, call your vet, and either head to your vet or the closest emergency facility immediately. Within just a few hours, the changes, irreversible liver and kidney failure, are not reversible. So if it's more than that, it is a universally fatal situation.
I understand that when the cold weather comes, you know, probably in more rural areas, there's more rodents around, you know, they're looking to escape the ice and snow. So they come inside, and people have traps or they have poisons that they put out. What are the risks there for a pet?
You know, the big risk with all the mouse and the rat baits is a lot of them are peanut butter, you know, based.
Right.
So they smell good, and apparently they taste pretty good too. So if you think your pet ate a bait, and it's, you know, you got the label or whatever, or even if you don't, you know, pick up your pet, head to the vet. Basically, these pets will be treated with vitamin K therapy, and in the vast majority of cases, everything will be fine. It's not deadly like antifreeze, but it can cause, you know, bleeding. So do go to the vet, get the vitamin K therapy. We do it for about a month, and most dogs are going to be just fine.
Okay, so I know, I mean, it's the time of year, but also because I feel like I need it. I eat heartier during winter months. You know, when you're outside, you burn more calories.
Sure.
You know, you're doing activities. How do we navigate that with our pets? Should we be feeding them more or not?
Yeah, absolutely. When it's really cold and you're going to spend some time outside, you need a little more food. So you've got more calories that you're going to burn to make energy so you can stay warm. You can feed your pet a little bit more. You could also home cook for your pet if that's an option for you. You know, for just a regular dog, you know, you could pick a lean protein, you know, chicken, turkey, beef, whatever it might be. Mix it one third with a long-acting carb like rice, potatoes, pasta, or oatmeal, some fresh veggies, you know, broccoli, cauliflower, green beans, cook them up and mix them all together. I think your dog will be very happy about that. If your pet's kind of pudgy, you could leave out the carbs and, you know, go with the protein and veggies 50-50, and your pet will be happy, and you probably will too.
I was going to say, can I come over for dinner? For owners who are trying to balance safety, exercise, and daily routines, what are your top simple habits that make the biggest difference in protecting pets through the coldest part of the year?
You know, really, I think try to keep things as normal as you possibly can. And even though it is cold, put on your jacket and put on your boots and get outside a little bit. Again, you know, with your pet, keep your meals pretty consistent. And if you are somewhere where it's 14 or 15 or so below zero, again, you know, get creative. Think up exercises and whatnot that you can enjoy with your pet, whether it's running up and down the stairs or just, you know, doing a series of yoga kind of exercises inside. Your pet will love it, and you'll probably find that you enjoy it just as much.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
And thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Brian Torrance, Angela Burke, Dr. Stephen Sia, and Dr. Carol Osborne. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic Newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic Newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contest prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.